Good evening. Thank you for coming, either online or in person. I think we've got some stragglers who are going to be joining us. It is my great delight to introduce Professor Kabir Sheikh from UCL. As you can see, he's Professor of Global Health Systems and Policy. He's previously led the, I met him at the Alliance for Health Policy and Systems Research at the WHO and
Health Systems Global.
He's done just about everything in relation to health systems internationally. So Kabir, you're going to tell us about the changing dynamics of mixed health systems in low and middle income countries. And you're going to speak for about 40 minutes and take some questions.
So, welcome, everyone, and thank you, Trish, for the kind words and for calling me here. It's a bit of a long-winded title, yeah, my talk. And this is Health Systems Week, I believe, for all of you. So I think I'm okay. You guys are all at Oxford University. You're all super smart. So this is a version of my inaugural professorial lecture that I gave last year. And you know, an inaugural is funny because it's your sort of opportunity to talk about yourself and your own journey. And I really felt quite awkward doing that. It's kind of not the thing we're used to doing. We're used to talking about our work, but hopefully I'll talk about my work through my own journey and also signal a little bit about what I've learned and what I think that means for the future of this field. So health systems research, health policy and systems research. It's quite a long talk. So I'm a little bit worried that I might end up talking a lot and not have enough time for dialogue, because I really like to talk with you guys and not just talk at you. So let me see if I can cut some bits out or just prioritize some bits. Okay, let's crack on. So this is my journey. I'm from India, I'm Indian, and I grew up in Western India. I did medicine in New Delhi. And so my first initial part of my career was very much shaped and formed by being a doctor in a busy government hospital in New Delhi. And that really got me thinking about systems, because it was kind of, I'm getting all these really complex issues coming to me and complex cases coming to me. And I find that I can only really scrape the surface of what's going on over there. And there's so much more happening in people's lives. The reality of working in a big hospital gave me a sort of exposure to all that happens behind the scenes. When we're doctors, we're very focused on the clinical case, but there's a whole lot happening behind the scenes that I actually found as interesting, if not more interesting, than the actual patient encounter. And that kind of drew me into thinking about systems. And then I went and worked with a research NGO. I did my doctorate at the London School of Hygiene. Then I worked at the Public Health Foundation of India, which is what they call an arm's length organization. It's a technical agency serving the government. So we functioned pretty much like a university. We had students, we did ran courses, but we also did research. And a lot of that research was specifically focused on answering questions that people in health systems and government health systems had, and really trying to be responsive to their problems. So it's not a conventional university in that our job was to support learning and change within health systems rather than to produce knowledge per se. And that kind of philosophy and that approach has really informed a lot of my research and my academic career as well. And then so after that few years at the Public Health Foundation of India, I joined WHO and I was there for 6 years. I color-coded all of these because they all represent different types of like sort of spheres of work, different arenas of work. And I think that's been really important for me as well in my career, that sort of overlap between teaching, research, but also policy and practice, and really having all of those mixed up together and having them inform each other. And then finally, I've now joined UCL. Well, not finally, I hope. I think that hopefully that I'm not going to sort of pass away after UCL, but I'll continue to do something. And in all of that, and then there's sort of all these other links that I've had. And this is not to kind of, you know, again, I feel very kind of a little bit show-offy talking about this, but that's not the idea. The idea is to just demonstrate that it's very important, it's been very important for me to have all these different strands feeding into each other. So I've been visiting at various universities, and that experience has been very formative. In fact, one of my first experiences teaching an international group of master's students was at BRAC University in Bangladesh. And I actually think that was like one of the most exciting and dynamic group of students I've ever worked with. And that was very formative for me as well. I learned a huge amount from them. So BRAC has this really interesting format where they actually have the whole master's in a rural setting in Bangladesh, where they're running a lot of their programs. So BRAC is one of Bangladesh's biggest NGOs. It's, you know, there's a Nobel Prize associated with them. They've been really influential in shaping the Bangladesh story. So what happens when you're in a setting like that is you can't really escape the realities of, you know, impoverishment of health systems in challenging situations, because they're literally outside your doorstep. And you kind of, you just step outside the campus and you see those every day. And so that's really important, I think, to sort of give people that exposure to what happens in the real world so that we're not just like removed from our settings. There's some other associations as well. And then I've always been involved with policy groups as well, because trying to sort of feed that practical experience back into thinking about how we can actually bring about change. So through my work with WHO. And then the other bit that I've been quite involved in is getting this community of health systems researchers together. Mm-hmm. So we've, as health systems research is not a fully evolved field, right? It really started only about 25 years ago. WHO set up a department on health systems research. There have been some publications, but there's no real canon. There's no like sort of fundamental understanding that this is a field that you can take in a master's or you can, you know, specialize in. So a lot of people arrive on it through a very twisted path. I mean, we are either doctors or we are social scientists or we are people working in management, and we arrive at these health systems problems. And that's actually, that interdisciplinary building of the field has really helped to shape it. So I got together with a few people, and I mean, a lot of people, and we started a membership society called Health Systems Global, which has now become quite active. They run a biennial global symposium. The next one is in Nagasaki in November. So if you get a chance, I think they're still looking at, I think the abstracts have closed now, but you can still register and go if you're interested, or maybe follow it online. So it's a few different sort of influences in my pathway. And when I say a road of bridges, I think what that's helped me to do is to think about a few different kinds of boundaries that I've spanned, and I think are really important for any professional in health systems to span. So I think a lot of my work has been focused in India, a little bit in Asia, other countries of Asia. And I think that depth of work in India, so like 10 years of working in India, has helped me to look at the world through a particular set of experiences, which is not unique to that setting, but it's given me a window. And it doesn't make me an expert on other settings, but it gives me a way of looking at other settings that's been quite interesting. And I'll reflect on some of that as well. So this sort of bridge between India and Asia and the rest of the world is an interesting boundary for me that I've tried to span. The idea of doing research and making research matter, I think that's really key. I mean, I think far too much research ends up on virtual shelves or actual shelves and doesn't get used. And there are specific reasons for that. It's all about the incentive structures. A lot of the ways that universities function, and I'm in a big university now, I think is deeply flawed, because we don't actually necessarily help to support learning in contexts where learning needs to happen. We are too focused on generating information. We're not focused enough on creating learning, if you know, you see the distinction. And I'll talk a little bit about that as well. And then this, what I already mentioned, this idea of looking at what's happening in health systems today versus what's going to happen to them in the future. And of course, nobody can really tell what's going to happen in the future, but we do have clues. We have some really big glaring hints staring right at us in the face. And I think it's important to look at some of those big hints and think about what the future might hold for us. So the first, kind of skipping on a bit, so there's like four parts. I've gone away from the rule of threes. One should never say have more than four topics, because more than three topics, because they don't really hold attention. But still, I'm going to try and plow through and go to the fourth as well. So the first big shift in my thinking, and in the thinking not just of myself, but a lot of other people working on health systems, has been on this idea of seeing health systems as social systems. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about governance, and my focus has been on health systems governance. So that's the area I specialize in, and I'll say a little bit about why I think that's important. And then a bit more about the work I've done, which is not research per se, but more like institution building around research to make research matter. And then finally, I'll end up with a little bit about the future of the field and what I think we should all be focusing on. Of course, I might be wrong, but please tell me if I am. So health systems are social systems. So when I first joined this sort of community of people working on health systems, we used to talk about primary healthcare all the time. I mean, I think it was the big topic, right, in the 90s through the 80s. And primary healthcare, as you've probably been exposed to very much, especially if you've had professors like those sitting in the front row here, is not just about the level of care that we deliver primary healthcare at on the front lines. It is about that, but it also goes beyond that. And it also speaks to this idea of a philosophy that it's not just about, providing services, but we also need to empower communities. We need to engage across sectors. We need to make sure that referral networks are well established. And actually, a lot of that comes from the principles of Alma Ata that were enshrined in a famous declaration from the 1970s. And a lot of us were kind of very influenced, not only technically, but also politically by that declaration, because it was really quite radical in some of its thinking. And if we go back to the original declaration, they talk a lot about things like community leadership and health planning. They talk about reducing elitism in modern medicine. I mean, it's really like these issues are still very, very prominent right now. And they talk about tackling social inequalities. And that's really what the basis of that was. So Alma Ata was really driven by recognizing specific social and systemic trends that exist in real world health systems and responding to them, and redressing them. On the other hand, then universal health coverage came up in the early 2000s, and that became another big sort of beacon flagship, right? Now, universal health coverage is extremely important, and it's much more scientific, it's much more comprehensive. But what UHC did is gave shape to our understanding of what health systems are, because that led to the building blocks framework, which you guys have probably studied today. And it laid out certain goals like aspirations around equity, around healthcare access. But the thing is, with universal health coverage, it lends itself to a lot more different types of interpretations than primary healthcare. Primary healthcare is very clear. These are the problems in society, and this is what we need to tackle. Universal health coverage says, these are the goals we want to achieve, and how can we achieve them? So there was a very different sort of set of ideas there, which pulled us in different directions. And one of the kinds of thought processes that was quite prevalent and is still quite prevalent is this idea of health systems as machines, that you sort of put inputs in at one end and you get outcomes out at the other end. And a lot of the frameworks that were developed, that's the WHO building blocks framework, an excellent framework. I'm not here to, denigrate these frameworks. They're really important and really useful frameworks. But they did lend themselves to a particular quite technocratic view of health systems, in which we think about systems as machines. And my experience was that that's important, it's interesting, but it's really insufficient to explain what actually happens in health systems. Either as a descriptive device or as an explanatory device. So that sort of, again, came from my experience of working in a health system in a low-income setting. And then I found a lot of people agreed with me, and, there was a lot of thinking already in this space, a lot of, fantastic researchers who'd already written about health systems as social institutions. Lucy Gilson was a major leading light in the field. She's written extensively about this, and Irina Jepong, Kara Hansen, a lot of other people have been thinking about these issues. So we got together and wrote a series of papers back then, which really kind of identified some of this understanding of and sort of placing health systems as being social institutions and not only as machines. So sort of moving away from machine thinking. And this is a series of papers we did in PLOS Medicine. So the three kind of major things we said is the first is that software, what we call software, is incredibly important for health systems. So software is the values, the politics, the intangible aspects, the rules and norms, the sometimes the informal norms, the ideas, the interests, you know, the things that are playing around and shaping health systems, but we can't actually always measure them or really fully grasp them. But it's important to try and understand them better, and that's really critical to how systems function. The second, of course, is that systems are complex, and I think that's not something new. But important to integrate that into our understanding, and also that decisions are not just made at the top of systems; they are made like so throughout systems. And actually, one of the most important theories was that of street level bureaucracy, which is that actually the most important person in a system is the person who's at the front line, and they are the ones actually making the decisions, because they are the ones interacting with the person who's using care, or you know, accessing services, or you know, they're controlling resources. They're the ultimate controller of resources, and what's happening above them is kind of like an ecosystem. It really shakes your idea of what a system is, what policy is, and where policies are being made and where decisions are being made. And the third is, of course, that health systems are social systems. And when I say social, it doesn't just, I like to use the word societal, because it actually identifies that health systems are part of society. And so the problems of society also reflect in the problems of health systems. So we'll come to that a little bit and give some examples. And one major example of that was this, mixed health systems. So this very much reflects, so I read some papers, very influential papers, which I find are incredibly important, haven't got enough importance, including one by Sania Nishtar, who was later became science minister of Pakistan. And she's now the chief executive officer of Gavi, the immunization agency, which is quite, for me, interesting, because she came from a very much a systems perspective, and now she's gone into an extremely vertical program and heading that up. She wrote this on mixed health systems being centrally planned government health services that operate side by side with private markets. And I think this is really important, because this describes a large number of health systems across the world, especially those in low and middle income countries, those which you might call the relatively less planned systems and economies. There's a sort of a laissez-faire approach when it comes to how private sectors operate in these countries. There's no real plan for them. They're just sort of there's a path dependency, and they exist side by side with the public sector. And why it's important also, not only for those countries, is that now we are seeing many countries slide back into that model, including this country. And we are seeing now an approach where you will see increasing competition between public and private. And that creates a unique set of phenomena, which, you know, can ultimately result in compromised public services. There's impacts on health equity and access to care. I won't go into it in too much detail because we don't have time, but there's much more to read about mixed health systems that I can point you to. So this is kind of like something that Sania Nishtar wrote about in 2010. But I don't think it's got enough traction, this understanding of mixed health systems and heterogeneity in health systems. And one kind of reflection of that is that just a few months ago, one of the chiefs of WHO made this tweet. He said, having a functional taxonomy of the private sector in health is important to facilitate effective engagement in health and well-being. So, I mean, we are in 2024 and we don't have an effective taxonomy of the private healthcare sector. We haven't properly understood what the private healthcare sector is. It's incredibly diverse. It's not just one thing. It's many, many different things. And understanding that is really important. And actually, he's a friend of mine. I think he's really trying to bring about some of these changes within organizations like WHO, who still function on a very old-fashioned thinking of what the private sector is. And this is one framework that I developed with some other colleagues in 2017, which tries to begin to unpack what this heterogeneity is. And this is, again, gives that sort of, again, that reflection of why health systems are social systems, and that'll kind of illustrate that a bit, hopefully. So this is one, what we might call, not a taxonomy, but almost like in a sociological sense, we use the word typology in sociology, which doesn't necessarily say that this is like a mathematical distribution, but it's like a way that people can organize their thoughts around heterogeneity. And we found it useful to think about diversity in axes rather than in categories. So for example, there's a whole range, a spectrum from the formal to the informal health sector. There's a spectrum from the specialized to the lay. There's even a spectrum from the private to the public. It's not a clear demarcation. There's a lot of private activity that happens in public sector. There's a lot of public-minded activity that happens in the private sector. And then there's what we call allopathic, which is Western biomedicine through to traditional or local health traditions, the non-allopathic. And again, that's also a spectrum. There's a lot of, it's not like you'll have people working only in Western biomedicine or only in local health traditions. Mm-hmm. You'll find people mixing their practices a lot. So these are all continuums. They are not, or continua, they are not discrete categories. And one thing we can take away is that the segment on the right tends to be, in a way, often philosophically, physically, and practically, logistically closer to communities, whereas the ones we think about all the time are the big hospitals and the doctors and the nurses and the operating theaters, and those are all on the left. That's what a lot of policy and our kind of day-to-day gets focused on when if you work in the policy sphere. But actually, they're kind of removed in some ways from the realities of people's lives. Of course, that's a very big generalization, but I think it holds up to a large extent. So that's one, just an example of a way of looking at heterogeneity and why health systems are so socially embedded. And it tells us that we should be looking much more at this right-hand side of the spectrum. Okay, that's. I'll skip this. This is just a photograph of the my collaborators in India. We worked on a number of issues. And some of the issues we worked on related to that sort of right side of the spectrum. The people in the health workforce who are relatively don't find a large voice in the kind of policy sphere. We looked at rural doctors. We looked at private practitioners who are often kind of neglected from a policy perspective in India. We looked at what we call TCAM practitioners, traditional complementary and alternative medical practitioners. And we looked at nurses. Again, here, nurses are still politically much more influential. There's a leadership structure, there are career pathways in the UK, but that's not the case in many other countries. And in India, certainly it was the case. So we undertook studies on a number of these, on these sort of marginal actors. And I think we'll give one example. So a lot of this was using qualitative methodologies, ethnographic approaches. I mean, people, I often get to ask, how is this different from journalism? And I say it is different from journalism because in good quality, qualitative research, we tend to avoid asking people about their opinions. We ask people about their experiences. And then we elicit the trends in their behavior, the trends in their responses from their accounts of their experiences. And that's much harder to do than asking people about their opinions. People are extremely free with their opinions and they're extremely closed about their experiences. So you need a very good skill set to actually do good quality qualitative research. But that's just my defense of qualitative research. Maybe I didn't need to give it. But this was an example of some work we did with rural doctors in rural Chhattisgarh, which is an insurgent affected area. It's a conflict zone in eastern India. So this is a bridge in Chhattisgarh. The other side is all insurgent territories, Naxalites. Who operate in that territory. So, and this is one of the instances where a number of security people were killed. That's a primary healthcare center over there. So really remote, really isolated area where there's barely any doctors and barely any health systems to speak of, but there are some. So we did this study in which we sort of flipped the question on its head and we said, okay, normally when we ask about So the bigger policy question here is doctors aren't well distributed, right, across different systems. Most of them get concentrated in cities. We want to get more people to the areas where they really need it. So the normal question to ask would be, how can we make doctors stay on in villages, right? Or we say, can we replace doctors with other types of health workers in those areas? So we said, let's ask a different sort of question. Let's ask the people who are actually there, let's ask them why they're there. Can we learn anything from those people? And so we did this sort of ethnography of those doctors who did stay on, and they were all remarkable people. I mean, you know, there's this kind of narrative that the system makes them out to be the losers, They're kind of like the people who couldn't afford, like, get into any better posting, right? So they're stuck there. And actually, they all have very interesting explanations for why they're there, and some of them are pretty intuitive, but it's really important to document that, right? Geographical and ethnic affinities. A lot of them were actually people from those areas with like family affinities, social affinities, tribal affinities, and they were just more comfortable in that environment. That's where they're from. And they're back with their people. It's not like they're saints. They're just kind of happy to be there and working with their people. Some of them were also, very inspiring people with like personal values of service and wanting to go back and give back. And then there's also these really important sort of practical considerations. Make sure there's a school, where you're going to post your doctors and nurses, and make sure there's, job security for these people. Give them their basic supports. This is a kind of a very condensed version of what our findings were. But it influenced policy because it's a striking evidence in support of affirmative action, for example. You need to prioritize educating people in professional medicine from those particular pockets, and so that they will go back and serve their own communities. It's just that simple. And we didn't have that evidence, so this helped us because we did this work with the ministry. So it fed directly into the ministry's the national policy for posting and transfer, and it has had an impact then on several state policies as well. So that was a bit about seeing systems. So that's already quite a lot. I've spoken quite a lot already, but let me maybe say a little bit about governance, and then I think I'll skip the next section and go straight to the third one. Yeah, so governance. A lot of my work has been on understanding governance. So there's this bit on the workforce that I described, and then there's a lot more on, there's another big strand on governance. So why governance? These are the kind of standard definitions of governance, right? Guidance of the health system. When it comes to health systems, guidance of the system through design, management, regulation, accountability, a lot of the words we hear, regulation, stewardship, institutions, rules, systems. Now, why did we decide to focus on governance? This wasn't just me. This was a whole team of us in India deciding to focus on governance. I think it came from a sort of a multitude of different insights as practitioners. So a lot of us came from the practice space. We weren't researchers per se. And we knew that governance challenges are the roadblocks because we'd experienced them ourselves. Not only as practitioners trying to get things done in systems, but also as citizens. So when I try, for example, getting a insurance payout in India, even as a well affluent doctor, I'm a doctor myself. I'm reasonably well off. If a family member goes to a hospital and I try to get an insurance payout, it's almost impossible. There's so much red tape and so much bureaucracy, and you have to stand in so many lines that you almost at the end of it just say, forget it, I just pay myself, right? So these are the kinds of challenges that we faced as individuals ourselves. And then, of course, that gets amplified like 10 times if you go further down the social order. And if you're underprivileged, then it's almost impossible to think about getting insurance payouts. And then we were interested in this as from an academic perspective as well. So the researchers pursued, and then I'm saying confronting the living constitution with the manifestations of the written. It's a mouthful, but it's really, really important. It kind of gets to the heart of what we do as governance researchers. We look at the rules that exist in right written form, and then we look at what people are actually doing, and we compare the two. And it's not just about saying, oh, A is different from B. It's about the fact that what people are actually doing is also driven by a bunch of rules, norms, patterns, but those are not written anywhere. There's a whole informal parallel system that functions side by side with the formal system. So, yeah, it's like it's interesting. I was struck by so Richard Horton, the editor of The Lancet, said something about he had an editorial the other day. He says the system is not working, right? And he's talking about the global health system. And our mutual friend Shreya Bimbola responded to that, with another tweet, and he said the system is working just fine. That is the system. It's supposed to not work for some people and it's supposed to work for other people, right? So I mean, it's a provocative kind of polar way of looking at it, but essentially the parallel system exists side by side with the formal system because it works for some people. It just works for the wrong set of people. Right? It works for the people who are benefiting from those parallel arrangements. It doesn't work for the people who it's supposed to be working for the benefit, the poor, the underprivileged, the people who really need the system to function for them. And that gets mirrored at the global level. So when people talk about corruption, I get quite, it's my little pet peeve. Corruption is not rent seeking. It's not payouts at the bottom of the food chain. It's this, the existence, our blindness to the way that entire systems are functioning for a particular set of interested actors and not for the broader public good. That's corruption. So anyway, that's just my pet peeve. I can we can get into that in more detail. So this is another one, this Amartya Sen. Again, very much the same thing. When you say justice, we shouldn't just focus on what should be happening. We should actually look at what's happening. Yeah, and that's really a strong statement for doing research on governance, doing research on health systems. We need to focus on what actually happens in actual lives rather than merely looking for ideal institutions and arrangements. Just a few more examples here. We did work on three different sets of institutions: community institutions, regulatory institutions, and, well, broadly speaking, ministries of health. So this is over a long period of time, several different projects. So this is a really interesting one, posting and transfer policies. It's kind of one of those really important functions of health systems. Making sure that people in the right place at the right time doing the right jobs. It's so boring, it's so basic that nobody thinks about it. It's kind of like, oh, this is just management. But it's crucial, absolutely critical to the system functioning of any system. And there are very clear factors driving it, and there are clear phenomena, and there are clear problems that exist within that can be understood and solved. So it's really important to research that. So I'll come to that in a little bit. So these are some findings we had: organized professional interests influence regulatory design and implementation. I mean, that's corruption, right? That's what I was talking about. It's like infiltration of private interests into the functioning of regulatory bodies, regulatory capture, in other words. Informal parallel arrangements for health worker deployment. So everybody kind of makes a deal, right? If you can buy yourself into a good posting. Sometimes actually there are some state governments, especially in Tamil Nadu, in India, which have actually implemented excellent posting and transfer policies. They do things like they post spouses together. They make sure there's like an incentive system. There's like schools in all the areas. They're very imaginative about the way they do their posting and transfers, and it actually works quite well. So a lot of issues around design gaps, functional clarity. So this is, of course, all research that fed directly into the policymakers' work. Not all of it was effective in bringing about change, but it did kind of throw a light into some of these very dark areas of health systems. Then we did a bunch of stuff on community systems. So again, sort of this is documenting failure. That's also really important. So there are something like 300,000 village health committees across India. And that's really the de facto mechanism to introduce community voice into health planning. So to a large extent, they don't work. So it was important to just document that, right? It's like you get some women, you get some lower castes, you get some people from underprivileged communities being represented on those committees. But ultimately, the social factors militate against them having an actual voice in on those committees. But there are instances where you see things shifting just by virtue of the committees being there. There are instances where people actually can exert can have a voice. You actually see some changes and some improvements in service delivery as a result of communities having a voice. So documenting those little successes, those little gains is also important. And also this, again, also went into the national policies for village health committees. Some of the local governance laws. So, for example, India has a policy on Panchayati Raj. So Panchayati Raj is local self-determination. It's like and that's not just for health. That's politically, it's like every village has the right to determine its own, resource, how its resources are allocated. And there's like, that's in law, that's constitutionally enshrined. So that was a really positive framework on the basis of which these village health committees could function, because the village health committees were subcommittees of the local health government. So again, laws are important. It's very boring, but you know, don't get rid of the laws. They're really important because they help to sort of maintain a status quo. They have to maintain, they have to give opportunities for positive things to happen. Then this was work we did at WHO on ministries of health. Ministries of health almost across the world are really stuck in the past. They still think they control what happens in health systems. How many of you work in ministries of health or have worked in ministries of health?
Two.
Maybe, I mean, you can share some of your experiences maybe after I'm done. But unfortunately, the demands on them are very different. They're not just focused on delivering services. Now, ministries of health are expected to be negotiators, stewards, regulators. They're supposed to handle climate change as well as, you know, delivering primary health care. And they're supposed to do all kinds of multi-sectoral stuff. It's really hard. They don't have the capacity to do that to a large extent. So we did this work in WHO on just putting up. We used to get a lot of requests in WHO from ministries of health saying, what should be our functions? I won't name the countries, but it's a very genuine question, right? What should we be doing? And there is no framework for, there's no like sort of normative framework for what a ministry of health should be doing. So that was a little bit part of the impetus for, so we would have to say, no, we don't have a framework. I was in a research department in WHO. We didn't even have the authority to put up norms and policies. But what we did do is try to think a little bit about what the capacities they should have in order to perform their functions, not just for the, in the old fashioned way, but in sort of from a future perspective. How can they, so a lot of that was about, yes, managing their sort of the URA functions, the written functions, but also preparing for change. You know, this became so important then when COVID happened. The ability to be ready for changes and to manage change. Relationship management, that's huge. I mean, none of the ministries of health are actually set up to manage the relationship with the private sector or with other sectors. By other sectors, I mean other like transport and education and environment and so forth. And values management was another big aspect. So, I mean, do we see ministries of health as thought leaders or as propagators of certain sets of values? And are they really being able to do that effectively? So there was a paper that came out of that, a working paper, WHO working paper. So all of that, that's, I mean, a very messy kind of broad view of the field. But I think I'm trying to draw some sort of inferences from that, which might help us to think about how change happens within health systems and what's important to focus on. And I'm going to give three examples of problems that we typically see in health systems across the world. Gaps in primary care, that's a big one. Inequitable access, were pretty much similar, yeah. Healthcare quality, right? And these are the immediate explanations that we have for these problems, right? Not enough skilled health workers, not distributed appropriately. When we try to hire people who are not physicians, they are not skilled enough to do the work that they are tasked to do. That's a big problem right now. That's a big issue in the UK right now that we are facing. Yeah. Low effectiveness of regulatory system. We don't really have the governance mechanisms in place. So typically, what are the kind of policy solutions we throw at these problems, right? We would try to find ways to equalize the availability of health workers. We throw technocratic solutions at these problems. We try to say skill non-physician workers more. We try to find sort of band-aid solutions for our governance institutions, strengthen them. Or maybe we even disband them. We say, oh, the regulation isn't working, so just give it up. You know, why regulate? So, but actually the issues, the underlying challenges are not always technocratic. They're often social and societal. So as they relate to these issues that some of which I highlighted, institutional capture. So institutions have been taken over by certain interests. Learning gaps, that's a big one. I don't think there's enough mechanisms for people to actually, for institutions and mechanisms to change and adapt. And that the Ministry of Health examples was one key one. So there is no way for ministries to redefine themselves. They don't have those inbuilt learning institutional linkages. Professional dominance, I didn't talk about that in depth, but for example, let me give you an example. In India, the nursing council is headed by a doctor. Professional dominance is a very well-documented sociological phenomenon. Elliot Friedson, if you want to read, wrote about this in the 1960s. Roger Jeffrey wrote about it in the 80s in a low and middle income country context. It's not about the fact that doctors are dominant. It's about that organized interests of medical professionals often work in such a way as to propagate their own interests at the expense of other cadres. And that really influences how things happen. It's a big determinant of health systems. We talk about social determinants. This is a social determinant of a health system. And the capacity gaps, simple capacity gaps. We don't have the skills to actually govern and to manage systems. Now, what's critical here, before I go there, is that none of these problems can really be solved from the outside. They're all issues that societies have to tackle from within. I mean, you can help them. I mean, I think the learning one is something. And that then, that for me, as somebody working now in a high-income country institution, I work at UCL, you guys are all at Oxford, it really helps me to think about what my role is in all of this. And I think it's this. And that's the one we should be focusing on. I don't think I can sit here and solve issues around corruption and institutional capture or professional dominance. I mean, I can shed light on them, but that's really about learning. But then that also really tells us about how health system strengthening can happen. And it needs to happen from the inside. And these are the different things that health systems can do about strengthening themselves. I mean, that's a framework. You can touch on that more. So I'm going to skip over this section, which is really about health systems, the kind of institutionalizing health systems research. And maybe talk a little bit about, just end with this bit on changing health systems. Yeah. So my title was Mixed Health Systems and looking at both the present and the future of health systems and how we can, as researchers, as people involved in learning, become more effective, become relevant in this context. So when we, nowadays, the discourse on health systems is entirely dominated by these topics, yeah? And understandably so. Ecological change, pandemics, current and future pandemics, and our preparedness for them or not. Humanitarian shocks. I mean, I think conflict is probably a big headline right now. And entire health systems are being decimated. Increasing applications of digital technology and AI. And I think along with that, disinformation. But I mean, I think I'll come to that. That's still a little bit subterranean. So this is what's grabbing the headlines. But then below that kind of little attention horizon that all the headlines are focusing on are some things that are much more predictable and clear. Urbanization. Africa is going to have 50 megacities in about 20 years. They're going to have there's going to be more urbanization in Africa than in all other continents put together. And that will come with different forms of commercialization of healthcare as well. Health market configurations are already changing completely. Private equity is making inroads into healthcare. That means that healthcare will no longer be run by doctors or by technicians. It will be run by the bottom line in a way that we cannot even imagine right now. These are huge shifts. Yeah? And these are things we can definitely predict. because I mean, we might want to sort of do something about it, but these are huge social changes that are happening. The spread of misinformation, I mean, I think that is undeniable. That's not just health. It's across the world. It's one of the major, the ability of information as well as misinformation to spread is and influence entire populations is a clear pattern that we are seeing and not one that's just going to go away. And below that is another attention horizon. And below that are the problems that we've seen for the last 50 years, and they remain unchanged. The governance failures, the health market failures, the same old software problems and issues, power conflict, contestation, and persistent inequities. And the point here is that some things are much more predictable than others. And I think we need to focus on all of those things together, not just any in isolation. You can't address the climate, you can't make systems climate-proof without addressing governance challenges or without addressing market failures. So all these things have to be taken in totality. And for that, we need a social science perspective. So if we are to be involved in effective health systems research, I think social sciences are underused. We need to throw the full weight of the social sciences to better understand and unpack these phenomena. We are seeing health systems as extensions of the clinic, and those are not necessarily the best methodologies by which to look at health systems. They are to some extent, but I think they are generally overprivileged when we consider the spectrum of research methodologies that we have at our disposal. So, from a future agenda perspective for the field, these are some big themes that I think we need to look at: understanding mixed health systems better and managing them, designing and managing systems for urbanizing and migrant mobile populations, integrating digital interventions, of course, dealing with epidemics and climate and conflict, and tackling the infodemic. But along with that, addressing the unfinished agendas of universal health coverage and primary health care. And how we do that, as I said already, is to, I think, upscale the use of social science approaches to study not only the technical aspects, the hardware of health systems, but also the software, to prioritize a lot of the kind of slightly boring functions of health systems, the what we call the organizational and institutional level issues, to understand the patterns, to understand, and it's doable. There are, you know, the social sciences have the tools and frameworks within which we can understand how health systems function, and we can use those much better. And to work closely with decision makers as much as possible so that our very learning we generate gets used.